Brooks, what's the main message you'd like us to get from Remembering the Future?
Well, one of the things that I wanted to consider was that we are eternal beings having this mortal experience. And my goodness, look how much energy and blood has been spilt over the argument of whether we have one mortal life or many mortal lives. What difference does it make? What we physicists wrestle with from time to time is the question, what's the speed limit in the universe? Well, I guess we're stuck with the speed of light because of Einstein and his supporters, and no matter how we think of it, it becomes impossible to pass unless we put some more variables in the formula. What happens as you approach the speed of light is time slows down. At the speed of light, time may become absolutely still. I was speaking with some of my colleagues, Dr. Ed Close, who wrote a great book called Transcendental Physics, and Dr. Amit Goswami. And I asked them, what does the universe look like from the perspective of a photon? And the answers were interesting. Ed Close says, if the photon leaves, let's say, Arcturus and heads for Earth, and you behold it as you walk out in the night sky, you say to yourself, gee, it's, 37 light years to get from Arcturus to my eye? How did that photon last, you know, for that pathway? How did it keep itself from being annihilated and twisted by magnetic fields and striking particles? But Ed says, actually, from the perspective of the photon, there is no pathway from Arcturus to Earth. It arrives instantaneously because time does not pass for the photon. I said, well, if that's the case, and human consciousness actually can perceive the speed of light, maybe beyond that, then the Big Bang never happened. It's only human consciousness that has slowed the universe down so that we can behold it. He said, that's exactly right. That's the takeaway from Remembering the Future, that the entire universe in the proper mindset is all now. It's all local. There is no past and future. You can behold it all. Now, that seems like a little daunting, a little humbling. Mm-hmm. In fact, it might be not so exciting. One of the things about mortal life that is exciting is the surprise, is that we get to savor things like chocolate and love and watching children grow up.
Well, and the beginning and the end.
And the beginning and the end, exactly right. So that means, and this is really the takeaway from the book, that we are actually participating in the creation of the universe. We're not spectators. And that changes our status in the game a lot, doesn't it, George?
We talked in the beginning about what you saw was organization in chaos. You look at the universe with your naked eye, through a telescope, pictures, you see organization everywhere. Yet it's really not all that way, is it?
Well, it isn't all that way. There is chaos out there because the ratio of the interaction of this energy isn't in the 1.618. It's not in phi. It's not in that resonance of the golden mean. And so it cannot coagulate. You know, we had an intelligent argument one time. What are the odds that a universe would be formed that was carbon-based, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, the way we have ours? And I listened to the arguments for a while, and of course, being a twisted, sick statistician, I said, you know, actually, if you work this equation backwards, this is the only kind of universe that could occur. Because if you look at the elements that stars put out, and certainly we've got a population of stars to pull from in our immediate galaxy and universe, all those stars put out a very narrow band of elements. In fact, if they were a tenth of a percent off, they would annihilate themselves and put nothing out. This is actually the only kind of universe that can form. So order that appears from the chaos of energy is the result of these constructive interferences coming together. That's why a proton is a proton is a proton. Of course, a hydrogen proton is a little heavier than an iron proton, and then it goes up the periodic chart from there, but that's just a holographic difference. The mass difference times energy is why Einstein's equations work so well.
Brooks, you talked just a little bit about consciousness. Let's talk a little bit more about that. Its ability to do these things.
Yeah, this is kind of the unknown. This is the consciousness constant that we're searching for. And I know it sounds kind of strange that scientists would be looking for this. Last year I went up and I visited the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. It's LIGO for short, or LIGO, L-I-G-O. There's two of them, one in Hanover, Washington, one in Louisiana, and there's one in Australia, and we're getting ready to launch one into space called LISA, which is the Laser Interferometer Space Antenna. Basically, what this does is it takes a single laser beam that's very, very tightly controlled, splits it in a mirror, sends it down 4-kilometer-long tubes that have all the air evacuated out of them. It reflects off of an extremely flat sapphire mirror, comes back, and they tune the two beams to interfere with one another and cancel each other out. Why do they do this in a big framing square sitting out on the Washington desert? So that they can listen to the vibrations of the universe. Now, this facility is run by a physicist named Dr. Fred Robb. And I was sitting down with him and talking with him, and he very frankly said, you know, what we're seeing, and this is very strange for me to say, but we are seeing photons, particles, popping into our dimension from another dimension. I said, what? What did you say? You're a mainstream government physicist, and you're saying that we have particles popping into our dimension from another dimension? He said, yes, and we're measuring them with this detector. So there appears to be a missing constant. We don't have it in our equations. Dr. Goswami, Dr. Close, myself, others, we're looking for the involvement of human consciousness in the formation of matter.